This is tape recording number 5108C18A, HEV2. A tape recorded lecture given by L. Ron Hubbard on the 18th of August, 1951. The title of this lecture is Human Evaluation. It is 38 minutes long. Copyright C, 1951-1973 by L. Ron Hubbard. All world performance rights reserved. This recording has been re-recorded by the flag audio unit of the flagship Apollo of the Sea Organization. In this lecture, Ron discusses the value of the chart of human evaluation in its application. And now, here is the master of ceremonies to introduce L. Ron Hubbard.
As I mentioned in my call, Dianetics has a great number of things said about it in the past year. All of these things were not necessarily good, but a great deal was said. Now, Dianetics, as most of us know it, has been devoted to processing, as we call it, teaching, and the helping or taking care of the sick. To me, emptying the asylums and the sanatoriums and the prisons are a worthwhile and a very high goal. However, there is another phase of Dianetics, an important one. That phase of Dianetics, which deals with industry and commerce, the professions, and the religions. It is this phase of Dianetics that we're going to deal with tonight. I believe that during this coming week, we can show you people in industry, in commerce, and in the professions a better method of doing your own job. I believe we have better tools with which you can do your job. The man who is responsible for Dianetics is also responsible for one of its children, human evaluation. And it's with a great deal of pleasure that I introduce its founder, L. Ron Hubbard.
Thank you. Thank you, Jack. I came up here with a young library. The three books here are all by Hubbard, but middle one happens to be by my Uncle Elbert. I found something very super quotable by Elbert, so I brought it down to read it to you concerning human beings. There's a schedule here of lectures this coming week. Each one of you, I believe, have one of these. And who knows, I may even stick to this outline. As people could tell you who know me and go on, this would be very strange, rare, and peculiar. But actually, this is an effort to lay out for you the prime principles, the basic tenets with which we are dealing in human evaluation. Human evaluation, of course, is born out of the fact that if you know some of the basic fundamentals of human thought, you can then predict behavior. Somebody downstairs a little while ago was saying this is the thing that people went into psychology classes in college to learn and were terribly disappointed never to have found out. That is rather true. I've heard this complaint rather consistently about psychology. Psychology, as a matter of fact, is not in very good repute in the society because of this. It gives us in Dianetics a very difficult time sometimes because we say, well, we know so-and-so and so-and-so about psychology. They say, well, but psychology's a lot of bunk. It doesn't work, so therefore Dianetics couldn't work either because it's also about the human mind. Well, this wonderful piece of logic is something we run into all too often. This is, all due respect, have absolutely nothing against psychology. As a matter of fact, if I had half as much against psychology as psychology has against Dianetics, I'd be a raving lunatic. So, the whole subject of human evaluation, of course, derives from an understanding of human behavior. Human behavior is something human beings have been rather curious about in the last few thousand years. Anytime you meet a human being and become associated with him socially, be of some benefit to know by looking at him, talking to him for a couple of minutes, what this individual had in store for you in his friendship with you. It would be of some small benefit to know whether or not he was going to run off with your wife or borrow your car and not come back with it, or whether or not he's going to be a good friend and would loan you that $100 when you needed it. Now, in the business sphere, where we have the high level of competition and contest and so on, human evaluation goes into two levels. One, the people with whom we do business as a business, and two, the people we employ to take care of our business. It's very important to know when one is dealing consistently or means to deal consistently with somebody in business, to have some forewarning if this individual is going to be something less than kind in his dealings, to have some idea in advance whether or not his word is to be trusted. If you notice, most business failures, actually those that are not founded upon sheer ineptitude, business failures most often next to that come about when trust is mistakenly placed in another human being. Be very nice to know how much you had to be on your guard with somebody doing business with him. A banker, for instance, is subjected to a continual running fire of, I want a nice little short-term note here of, I can use $5,000, trying to select out of the mass of people that are coming in front of his desk, one right after the other, the person who will pay it back. Now, the banker has had to go around Robin Hood's barn about this, and he says, by the way, he's been stung so often through an inability to know that he's had to go around Robin Hood's barn as his test. He says, how much collateral you got? And you say, well, I've got so-and-so. And he says, you want to borrow $5,000? All right, you want to borrow $5,000? You've got $5,000 in the bank. Now, if you leave your $5,000 in the bank, we'll loan you the $5,000. In other words, bankers have become very trusting through an inability to forecast who is going to repay the loan. It'd be very interesting to a banker to know with considerable accuracy who would and who wouldn't. In the matter of running a business, it becomes of the greatest interest to an employer who will be what in his business staff. He has a hard time with it. Matter of fact, in the field of Dianetics, we have had a bit of that. I'm going to read you this little bit by Elbert here in a moment on that subject. The various applications, then, of human evaluation are valuable wherever you have two human beings newly met and without past experience with each other. You had a method of establishing with a human being a few years of experience in a few minutes. It would have some value. On the subject of employers and employees, this one in particular, I was very interested that a few years ago, Elbert had dashed out this thing. It says that it was written one night after supper in a single hour. The New York Central Railroad ordered, after they had seen this in one of Hubbard's magazines, they ordered 100,000 copies of it and distributed it to their employees. And then their employees evidently kept distributing this to other people, so they ordered 500,000 copies. And by that time, Andrew Carnegie and a few of the boys had stepped in, and they began to order this little pamphlet until finally there were millions and millions of these little bits, message to Garcia, distributed throughout America in this fashion. It demonstrates that there is a small amount of anxiety then on the subject of trying to find a good man to employ. He writes, in all this Cuban business, there is one man stands out on the horizon of my memory like Mars at perihelion. When war broke out between Spain and the United States, it was necessary to communicate quickly with the leader of the insurgents. Garcia was somewhere in the mountain fastnesses of Cuba. Nobody knew where. No mail or telegraph could reach him. The president must secure his cooperation quickly. What to do? Someone said to the president, there's a fellow by the name of Rowan. We'll find Garcia for you if anybody can. Rowan was sent for and given a letter to be delivered to Garcia. How the fellow named Rowan took the letter, sealed it up in an oilskin pouch, strapped it over his heart, and 4 days landed by night off the coast of Cuba from an open boat, disappeared into the jungle, and in 3 weeks came out on the other side of the island, having traversed the hostile country on foot, and delivered his message to Garcia, are things I have no special desire now to tell you in detail. The point that I wish to make is this. McKinley gave Rowan a letter to be delivered to Garcia. Rowan took the letter and did not ask, where is he at? By the eternal, there is a man whose form should be cast in depthless bronze and the statue placed in every college of the land. It is not book learning young men need, but a stiffening of the vertebrae which will cause them to be loyal to a trust, to act promptly, concentrate their energies, do a thing, carry a message to Garcia. General Garcia is dead now, but there are other Garcias. No man who has endeavored to carry out an enterprise where many hands are needed, but has been well nigh appalled at times by the imbecility of the average man, the inability or unwillingness to concentrate on a thing and do it. Slipshod assistance, foolish inattention, doughty indifference, and half-hearted work seem the rule. And no man succeeds unless by hook or crook or threat he forces or bribes other men to assist him, or mayhap God in his goodness performs a miracle and sends him an angel of light for an assistant. You, reader, put this matter to a test. You are sitting now in your office. Six clerks are within easy call. Summon anyone and make this request. Please look up in the encyclopedia and make a brief memorandum for me concerning the life of Correggio. Will the clerk quietly say, yes, sir, and go do the task? On your life, he will not. He will look at you out of a fishy eye and ask one or more of the following questions. Who was he? Which encyclopedia? Where is the encyclopedia? Was I hired for that? Don't you mean Bismarck? What's the matter with Charlie doing it? Is he dead? Is there any hurry? Shan't I bring you the book and let you look it up for yourself? What do you want me to know for? And I will lay you 10-1 that after you have answered the questions and explained how to find the information and why you want it, the clerk will go off and get one of the other clerks to help you try to find Garcia and then come back and tell you there is no such man. Of course, I may lose my bet, but according to the law of average, I will not. Now, if you are wise, you will not bother to explain to your assistant that Correggio is indexed under the C's, not under the K's. But you will smile sweetly and say, never mind, and go look it up for yourself. And this incapacity for independent action, this moral stupidity, this infirmity of the will, this unwillingness to cheerfully catch hold and lift, these are the things that put pure socialism so far into the future. If men will not act for themselves, what will they do when the benefit of their effort is for all? A first mate with knotted clubs seems necessary, and the dread of getting the bounce Saturday night holds many a worker to his place. Advertise for a stenographer, 9 out of 10 who apply can neither spell nor punctuate and do not think it necessary to. Can such a one carry a message to Garcia? You see that bookkeeper, said the foreman to me, in a large factory? Yes, what about him? Well, he's a fine accountant, but if I'd send him up to town on an errand, he might accomplish the errand all right, and on the other hand, might stop at 4 saloons on the way, and when he got to Main Street, would forget what he'd been sent for. Can such a man be entrusted to carry a message to Garcia? We have recently been hearing such maudlin sympathy expressed for the downtrodden denizens of the sweatshop and the homeless wanderer searching for honest employment. And with it all, often go hard words for the men in power. Nothing is said about the employer who grows old before his time and in a vain attempt to get frowsy ne'er-do-wells to do intelligent work. And his long, patient striving after help that does nothing but loaf when his back is turned. And every... It was bitter. As a matter of fact, he'd been running Roycroft for some time, a whole town of people. In every store and factory, there's a constant weeding out process going on. The employer is constantly sending away help that have shown their incapacity further the interests of the business, and others are being taken on. No matter how good times are, this sorting continues. Only if times are hard and work is scarce, the sorting is done finer. But out and forever, out, the incompetent and unworthy go. It is the survival of the fittest. Self-interest prompts every employee to keep the best, those who can carry a message to Gotcha. As I say, he was bitter. But the fact of the matter is, the tremendous expense to a business in running the business as a testing crucible for employees, if added up, would probably make a lot of businessmen faint. Not only that, but the employees themselves, since you cannot cross a management between management and labor. There's practically no such thing as labor. It's management of a lot and management of a little. And the people trying to do their jobs in the plant, these too are very definitely affected by using the whole business as a crucible by which you test employees. Now, the more employees that you hire, the harder it is to keep a line until you work up to that epitome, or you might say that climax of all nonsense, the U.S. government. I mean, you can even get that ridiculous. You can have all sorts of beautiful tests, civil service tests. It says, do you have a high school diploma? Do you have a college diploma? Have you ever been in jail? Are you married? Do you have any children? You put down all this on government employment record, and they look it all over, and they say, yup, hire him or don't hire him or something of the sort. These efforts to discover data about an individual cost a great deal of money. They cost a great deal of time. And they sometimes cost a business its efficiency to a point where the business will fail, which might otherwise have succeeded. All because the business itself had to be used as a testing ground. Now, every time you bring in somebody, if you had the feeling like you were hiring a pig in the poke, you put him on the job. 3 months later, you happen to wonder if that job, that fellow's doing well, and you find out the whole job has collapsed and it stopped a whole assembly line down the way here. That becomes very serious, doesn't it? Well, that's only one aspect of it. In the business of counseling, in the business of trying to help and aid one's fellow man, it's very important to know who and what one is trying to aid. For instance, giving understanding or philanthropy to individuals. Every so often on the assembly line, there's a deadbeat. There is a professional desirer of sympathy. There is a professional, I'm trying not to use the slang terms, but some of these people in this line of people seeking aid are very, very deserving, and some of them are not. How do you tell the difference? How do you tell when a man is telling the truth? Is there a way of knowing whether or not a man is telling the truth without subjecting him to a lie detector, which has a limited usefulness, and to which he very often objects? And it's very difficult in the ordinary course of human affairs to go around carrying one of these lie detectors under your arm. It weighs several pounds. But there is a way. There is a way of telling this. That's what we're going to cover this week. The whole subject of human evaluation is something that man has been trying to reach for a long time. In looking over the books of the ancients and the ideas that were handed down before things were written, I know man has been interested in trying to discover this for 4,500 years. I'm not trying to tell you that it all at one fell swoop. It was suddenly discovered. There was an accumulation of information over those 4,500 years. A gradual accumulation, trying to find what was important in what had been accumulated was very important. Organizing then that with which people had worked in the past, organizing it, evaluating it, and putting it together paid off. Paid off in the form of Dianetics. It took a long time. There's a lot in Dianetics already. That is to say, there's a fellow by the name of Freud. He had the idea that all you had to do is clear up somebody's libido and he would begin living. Freud, in a rather heartbroken little memorial written about 1920, said psychoanalysis, terminable or interminable. And in that little monograph, he stated that his hopes were dead. It had not worked. He needn't have felt so badly about it. Naturally, he'd been up against the American Medical Association, the probably American Psychiatric Association, the Association for the Rehabilitation of Cockeyed Alienists, the Association for the Suppression of Associations which try to advance something to associate about. And he had, in short, been pushing an awful lot of opposition in front of him, and he didn't have any tool with which to clean this up so he could keep his own enthusiasm. So by about 1920, he was dead on the subject. But he had contributed something enormously important. Working with Breuer, he had found out that if you can get a fellow to remember back to his earliest times and get him to remember certain things, he got better. Freud didn't know, and he eventually admitted he didn't know why he got better. But he got better sometimes. And a fellow by the name of Charcot, 1832, was experimenting with hypnotism. He found out there were some strange conditions of the mind by which you looked at somebody fixedly and they went unconscious. Little things like this back along the track. Well, assemble those things, become Dianetics. 1930, I had known a fellow by the name of Commander Thompson. Commander Thompson had studied under Freud in Vienna. So I'd known him before 1930, by the way. And he was a friend of the family's. Old Commander Thompson trained cats. He had a cat named Psycho. And a black cat with a crooked tail. And he had Psycho trained to sit up and do other things. He taught me how to train cats. I've never had any luck with it, but he taught me how. It's either the cat's fault or he didn't teach me right. But he got me very interested in the subject of the human mind. Why is it that somebody starts to say one thing and says something else, but the something else he has said is a clue to his character or what he is trying to hide? Interesting gimmicks like this. That's a gimmick. That's no vast importance. But 1930, when I came back to school, I never got inside of high school. I went into engineering school. First off, fooled them completely. And my father said, you're going to engineering school. And I said, oh, no, I'm not. I'm going to write. So I went to engineering school. And in engineering school, they had an interesting little course called Atomic Molecular Phenomena. Of course, nothing would ever come of this. There were those of us in class who believed that the mystic and secret forces and powers of the universe were somehow hidden in atomic and molecular phenomena. There were fellows there, wild-haired, wild-eyed radicals, these students, who believed that a few pennyweights of some mysterious element exploded in a certain fashion could wipe out an enormous city. Well, naturally, nothing like that could happen. Not until Hiroshima would anybody really believe it. Up until that time, the A-bomb was a science fictioneer's dream. Then all of a sudden, boom. That validated the boys who had struggled forward from 1930 on the track of atomic and molecular phenomena up to the A-bomb. I was very radical, even more radical than they were. I said, atomic and molecular phenomena is very interesting. It must have something to do with the energy of life. Somewhere in here is life energy. We've described it somehow, and the description is here, but we don't know quite where it's here. Now, it's possible. It's possible that with this new branch of nuclear physics, we might be able to locate the energy of life. And everybody says, oh, heavens, everybody knows everybody's dead. What do you mean, the energy of life? So I went to work, working in the laboratory, Professor Brown there. And I found out that there was no way to store memory. Atomic molecular phenomena did not describe an energy which would store in the neurons and act as memory. The latest theory on this was a Viennese theory. All these things come from Vienna, particularly when they don't work. This Viennese theory, oh, by the way, this was fantastic. This theory is in a book that thick, all in German, with adverbial and participial clauses appended to the genders. And this describes how, oh, accurately, just as though the fellow had been right there watching it. It describes how the mind thinks up a thought or sees something or feels something or hears something and then stores it in a pole, in a punched protein molecule. Now, a protein molecule is so small you can't see it in the microscope, but he figured out that there were 10 holes in one of these molecules, and that each hole took about what he called 1,000 shots. In other words, 1,000 memories were stored in each little one of these protein molecules, in each hole, and that'd make 10,000 per molecule. And there's 10 to the 21st binary digits of neurons. That's a big number. If I started writing that number, it'd practically cover that board column after column. 10 to the 21st power binary digits of neurons. And they stored at the rate of 10,000 specific memories per molecule. And this Viennese had done the whole job all the way through except one thing. He'd never looked over into atomic molecular phenomena and found out what wavelength was. There is no wavelength that small. If it is that minute, it is so far above the range of ultra light that it's some unimaginable distance, something like how far away is an island universe. It's so microscopic that it will not register any known instrument. Therefore, the theory is suspicious. But accepting the theory, believing that this theory existed, we figure this thing up and we find out that the human mind does not have enough, even with that terrific number, it does not have enough storage space to store the memories of 3 months. Just allowing that this system took place. And that's not the minor observations of 3 months. Those are just the major observations of 3 months. This was a mathematical job. I guess the fellow could talk very beautiful German, but he couldn't talk very good mathematics. And when it came down to there, all of a sudden, boom! That was the ne plus ultra, ultra, ultra of all the theories of memory storage and human energy. Took it around and showed it to Dr. William Melanson White. He was head of St. Elizabeth's, where they sent the naval officers after they'd received their fifth contradiction from the Navy Department. And old Doc White said, yep, gosh. And I said, well, what do you think about it? I mean, and so on and so on. Well, naturally, not very much is known about structure. This understatement frankly blew my stack, and I realized suddenly for the first time, I was looking for something all this time that I thought people knew about. There was a psychology department, there were doctors, all these people, they certainly must know. Well, they all acted like they did. And after old Doc White gave me this blank stare and so forth, and sort of a so what, and this is just another puzzle on top of all these other puzzles, I went over to the psychology department, and I said, what are you guys doing over here? Oh, you see this electric plate? Well, if a rat runs along here and he hasn't been fed for 3 days... And I said, gee, that's fascinating. Now, what do you know about memory storage?
Burk.
This rat. Very anxiously, back to the rat. Well, I found out, actually, in the course of about a week, I was Alice in Wonderland. I didn't much like being Alice in Wonderland. I went on trying against all odds to believe that there was some rationale in the field of epistemology, human thought, and human behavior. In spite of all contradictions, I clung to this belief. I went out of school. Nobody was interested in this fact that nobody knew. They accepted the fact that it wasn't well known. I went into the field of writing. You know, my father said, you go to engineering school. And I said, no, I want to write. And I went to engineering school, so professionally I wrote. I got even with him. In an effort to support these researches, because I kept right on researching, my wife would tear her hair out by the handfuls when she would get bills for books. Bill for $150. A discourse on the mystical and spiritual principles of the Magi. Rare. God's sakes. Well, I'd say I wrote a novelette last week, and that brought in $140, frankly. A lot of my money going out along this line, accumulating this stuff, studying, trying to figure it out. It took me to about 1938 to find out the first thing you had to know was a dynamic principle of existence that you could agree on, and maybe you could take off from there and you could find energy. Well, between there and now, there's been assembled quite a bit of material on the energy of thought. We know some of its behavior and some of its component parts. We can't yet take a human being and, put a hole in his arm, give him a shot, and put more life into him. We can't do it that way. That's very simple, but that hasn't been done yet. We can't, for instance, take a dead man and bring out a couple of cubic centimeters of life and chuck him down the gullet, and he walks, takes up his bed and walks. We can't do that yet. Be a very, very handy gimmick if we could, but we can restore the life that he has, and we may even be putting a little more life back into him just by handling this energy seemingly the way it ought to be handled. Dianetics, unfortunately, for its repute, immediately sagged off, not on just human behavior, but immediately went into the field of mental healing. For instance, this first book, The Modern Science of Mental Health, would not be accepted by the publisher unless it had to do with mental health. This is a big psychiatric textbook house, this Hermitage House. And they were very interested, but only as it pertained to sanity, insanity, sickness. That's not too good, because this field is much broader in the field of human behavior than it is in the field of illness. But maybe one is being too harsh when he says the illness of the individual. He's talking now about the illness of the individual. Why is a social order sick? Why does a business get sick? Why do groups dwindle and perish? Why does the U.S. government get like it is today? These calamities can occur only in ignorance of the fundamentals of human behavior. It's terrifically important to make people well. It's also very important to know how sick they are. You might say that human evaluation is a sort of a diagnosis of behavior. And it's possible to make a diagnosis of reaction then with this rather rapidly. We can actually make a test of it. Matter of fact, I've been trying to get some instruments in the last few months. Haven't been trying very hard, but it appears that the vibration level of a human being is, I have frankly no data for this. I'm trying to get some instruments to measure it. It's apparently along about the supersonic range. You just got up into the supersonic range. Evidently, the tone scale that we talked about evidently its vibration level is in just in the supersonic range. Here's data for that. Somebody invented a washing machine. The Japanese were going to kill off all the soldiers that confronted them by throwing deadly supersonic waves at them. They found out that this would kill bacteria and kill mice. Here were mice and rats again. And they got this thing out on the field of battle and nobody died. So after the war, somebody came along and made a washing machine out of it. Now, the way you make a washing machine out of it is you just turn it up to a high supersonic vibration with a heavy volume, and it shakes the clothes in a barrel or something of the sort and shakes the dirt out of it. But, of course, it's vibrating so fast that it's way above the range of human hearing. Well, when they first brought these washing machines out, a few of them were sold, but the housewives would have nothing to do with them whatsoever. They wouldn't touch them. So the company took this machine back and figured it out for a while, and then they speeded it up, gave it a little bit higher vibration, and after that, the machine sold very well. You could go near one of these washing machines, you felt so smooth and so happy and so cheerful. In other words, actually, you could get a human being acting in sympathetic vibration on the supersonic range. I was kidding the auditors around here one day. I said, you know, Manning's coffee shop up in Seattle has a coffee roaster right out in the window, and they blow this big fan across the coffee roaster out into the street, and people walk along there and they go in and have a cup of coffee. Well, I was telling them about this, and I said, now the thing to do is to get several of these high-speed washing machine motors and put them across in front of the foundation. Actually, it'd probably work. Not that we want anybody to come in off the street. Anyhow, the values, I think, of human evaluation are very difficult to sketch in a few minutes. I think you can conceive that there is some value to this. If we knew, for instance, the fellow comes in, we take a look at him, we see certain things about him, then we know that certain other things will follow, rather inevitably. And we can read him across a certain level. We can predict his behavior under various circumstances. If we're doing business with him, we would know in advance what he would do. Is he honest? What is his ethic level? What is his responsibility level? What is his persistence level? Will he persist on a given task? Is he responsible concerning the things he has been had given into his charge? These things, perhaps, we could answer with some considerable accuracy if we had an accurate scale of human evaluation. Now, second half, I want to talk to you about the dynamics of existence and just go on sketching the derivation and uses of human evaluation and this chart. Shall we take a break?